welcome to Dynasty As They Want to Be, a podcast where we drill into every episode of the iconic 1980s television series Dynasty. I'm your host, Derek J. Lang, and with me is my co-host, Kyler K. Jafari.
Welcome, savages.
Oh my gosh, what an amazing moment we had this week. Dame Joan Collins came to Palm Springs, and we were there to lap it up. What did you think about her appearance at the Palm Springs
Speak series? She was especially vivacious. And
yeah,
you think like, well, she could just have been doing this forever and how is she going to deliver? But she does, and she do. And the thing is, I think I said this before, like she's not really like fixated on the Dynasty years or really any years. Mm-hmm. She seems to just sort of touch on all of it and have sort of a sense of humor about all of the projects and characters.
Yeah.
So I appreciate all of that. So, you know, Joan had a cold apparently, and that's been going around. It's January after all. But she was like a super trooper. She was there to deliver the goods, and like honestly it just felt very sincere. Like it just seemed like she was happy to be on stage and talk about things. Like there was no real, it wasn't forced, and it wasn't a performance even, really. It was just Joan, you know, with a microphone. And I think it only gets a little bit strange when, like, people start asking questions. It's always a little bit of a bummer when, like, somebody comes out with, like, some crazy question, which, like, hey, look, we're all fans, so I get it. Like, Joan's not prepared for some of that moment.
Yeah, your fucking inappropriate sex question.
Yeah, there was that, and...
Or, you remember my cousin? She met you in 1968? Like, get the fuck out of here with that. Nobody remembers that.
Joan is not going to remember who she had a cigarette and a martini with in the fall of 1902.
She like, shouldn't. The expectation should not be there.
But I think that's sort of a testament to what people associate. Like that's how much people love Joan, is that, you know, like they want her to remember those things and they want her to be there for those moments that, you know, that are in everybody's mind.
What was the biggest revelation for you that you may not necessarily have known about that you learned when you heard her speak?
There was a moment about Cleopatra, because I still have never really sort of disentangled what Joan Collins versus Elizabeth Taylor.
Right. Where did Joan really end means? And Elizabeth begin?
Well, I mean, I think they were sort of on like parallel tracks and they just never met. But they apparently met sort of kind of in this moment. And I'm not really sure like where Joan falls on the map of Elizabeth Taylor. But I like that she kind of mentioned it, because I had always felt like they had a little bit of a rivalry. Maybe they didn't. And I'm not going to like try to project one if there isn't one.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are women who were acting at a time and doing very similar things. And so it's interesting to hear like Joan sort of talk about, you know, being in Cleopatra or not being in Cleopatra, as it were.
Right. Well, I mean, I think she outright said that she was invited to be on the casting couch and she was like, no. And that's what separated her
and
from the lead role.
That's actually, so you're asking me that original question, which I think is where I wind up. Like, I don't really see Elizabeth Taylor doing casting couch things. Maybe she did. Maybe she didn't. She's not here to talk about it. So I'm not going to ascribe anything.
Yeah,
however,
I mean, we're just going off of hearsay.
You know, Elizabeth Taylor, you know, made her own way in much the same way that like Joan did. So I can't really think that that's really what the story was. But that was like sort of interesting that Joan threw that out there.
Yes. After the Palm Springs Speaks series with Joan, there was an amazing after party organized by Kiki Tormo.
I was excited because, like, you know, Palm Springs has like these sort of little like niche moments, and this was certainly one, and loved every moment of that moment. And you know, you got to judge the
costume contest.
I think it was funny that it turned out that the Claudia Blaisdell outfit, which I don't even know if that was on purpose. I don't think that it was, but it doesn't really matter, because costume is not about what the clothes are. Costume is about how you wear them and what you do while you're wearing them. It's an attitude. It's a way of being. And so that was like, yeah, it was just fascinating that somebody had dialed into that moment. And yet there were so many people that were just like, they're doing the dynasty things. So hip, hip, hooray.
All right. Well, should we take a break and get into this week's episode?
All right. We'll take a break.
Kyler, your hair is looking fire. You look like you're ready for a fling with the oil tycoon. Mm. Tell everybody what's going on upstairs.
So this is like when you bake a potato, you need that tin foil. Before blow drying my mane, I used Sauce Beauty's Hot Sauce Thermal Protection Spray to keep my hair from going into a frizzy tizzy.
Excuse me, did you say hot sauce?
Mm-hmm. Sauce Beauty is a delicious new hair care line inspired by the flavors you love. And I love me some hot sauce.
I hear that. Sauce Beauty's cayenne-infused heat protector soothes with aloe and argan oil, leaving hairdos feeling soft and smooth. Don't be afraid to bring the heat like Kyler did to his do. Kyler and I are proud that Sauce Beauty is a sponsor of Dynasty As They Want to Be. All their products are clean. That means alcohol, gluten, parabens, salt, and sulfate free.
And Sauce Beauty isn't just for hotheads.
Like they you.
They have moisturizing shampoos, conditioners, and other hair treatments inspired by guacamole, chimichurri, and extra virgin olive oil.
Virgin. You can find out more at saucebeauty.com.
You say potato, I say hot potato.
Welcome back. Well, after last week's kind of stinker of an episode, this may be my new favorite episode
of
Dynasty
ever. This episode was bonkers town. Yeah, I almost feel like we were being set up in this prior episode because it was such a snooze fest. And then, like,
I was ready to shut the podcast down.
We got jerked right back in the other direction.
Yeah, no, this was rejuvenating, enthralling. And the performances were amazing. I mean, even Dr. Tiramisu was kind of giving me something. And, you know, he's my least favorite character.
Well, because
now
he was finally relegated to, like, B-plot status where he belongs. And he had scant dialogue and not much to do. And
but his
that's
whole
all
kind
I
of
needed from him.
Raison d'etre for being here came back into the picture. And I've
his
been,
reason for being here.
Yes. I wondered what was happening with his backstory and why he just glossed over that so easily.
No, I didn't. I wasn't wondering at all.
But I'm glad that we kind of swung back around on that. So yeah, round
Wait,
of applause.
Wait, is that like a really sideways reference to brother hanging?
Where do we start?
Well, I don't know. The problem is we know where we finish because that's like what's so exciting about this episode. But, you know, you were talking about the acting. I have to say my queen, Pamela Bellwood, I'm a little like she's edgy. I'm not sure I'm liking what's going on, and it's not her fault. I said this before, like they've pushed her, like they've like relegated her into this like awful Stepford wife crazy person character.
Yes, they've completely leaned into the crazy, and I was a little bit jarred by it last week, but now maybe that I've had some time to synthesize it, I'm kind of into it. So in defense of Pamela Bellwood and Claudia Blaisdell, I think she's dealing with this trauma. And I think the trauma, she's regressed. Her mental health has regressed.
Well, obviously, that's what they're going for. And that's what I think she's going for. But I think we finally found the limits of Pamela Bellwood's acting. And that's a shocker for me. But this is, it's a little bit wooden. And it's like sad because I know it's all because they've unsexed her, like, and I say that like in the Lady Macbeth way, where she's no longer this like powerful goddess of love and, you know,
well,
steering the plot.
She can't be, and especially now that we have the bodies, I've been waiting for the CSI Ecuador evidence so we can finally move on from Matthew and Lindsay. All season long, we've been dealing with this, but we finally got confirmation from a telex, which, you know, I guess is the text message of 82, that their bodies were found. They're actually dead in Ecuador. And I think this is going to, well, obviously it's sending her into even darker places.
Yeah, she's really circling the drain at this point. I mean, like we end with her like, is she not with the baby, and then roll credits, like a little creepy, and they ought to know better than to leave, you know, crazy Claudia upstairs alone with the baby in the
nursery.
Well,
they were all very indisposed downstairs for the Tennessee Williams play that Al Corley was acting in. So I get it. You know, it was an upstairs downstairs situation.
But not like you've ever seen before.
Yeah, not an upstairs downstairs situation involving the servants, which, my God, Denver Carrington must be doing really well, because they've
hired an
all
new staff. But apparently they're all terrible, because, you know, now they're serving up burnt bacon and, you know, stale eggs, and take this away because I can't eat that for breakfast.
Yeah, I was a little surprised Mrs. Gunnarsson doesn't have it together if she's been cooking for Blake all these years.
Mrs. Gunnarsson she's like resting on her laurels.
I think maybe she just does the night shift and somebody else is doing the breakfast.
Hosting. She's just collecting a paycheck at this point.
But yeah, they gather all the staff. Tony, Janetta's back, Mrs. Gunnarsson, a bunch of old white guys we've never seen before that I guess are butlers, to welcome home baby Blake Carrington Colby Jr. This was a really fun moment. I thought the direction and the production was great. It was so over the top, and it was selling this fact that Blake thinks that the baby is, you know, a little prince, the heir apparent to Stephen keeps
saying. Well, this is like, you know, it might be obvious to call Blake patriarchal, you know, in the sense that that's normally a derogatory term, at least in today's parlance.
Right.
But actually, he kind of really is a patriarch. He's a rich father of a wealthy family that controls everything. So he's a patriarch.
Yeah. Well, and I think he's given up on his kids. I mean, Fallon's a woman, as she said way back in season one. She's never going to have control of Denver Carrington. You know, Blake and Steven's relationship just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. Talk about circling the drain.
Yeah, that one's already like ashes in the fireplace. But the thing is Blake doesn't look at bringing a grandson home as just a new child in the world. This is like, oh, now I finally have somebody to pass on my empire.
Right. It's like a business decision.
Right.
Or opportunity.
Again, very patriarchal, right? The other thing that he does that's like super patriarchal is he's always like controlling the narrative. And in this episode, you get like two very like literal instances of it. Like, he's basically telling Claudia the news from the telex, and he's like sort of narrating this whole story. Well, your husband's dead and they found him in the jungle. And
he's got to be in control.
Right. And like, Claudia's like, yeah, I already knew that. I got a telex too a few days ago. I already knew about all of this. And so it's like, it's classic, like Blake's like going to be the one telling the story, but it's her story, and her story is much more substantial, to the point that, you know, she has nothing left to live for, and she's just gone totally cuckoo bananas at this point.
Well, the one thing I will say for Claudia is that she has remarkable healing ability. To be shot and then to not be wearing a bandage a couple of days later and have your...
She even kind of feels around our head because she's not sure which side it was on.
I know, she forgot.
I mean,
they don't really explain how much time has passed, but certainly you would have had to have your head shaved for that sucking procedure that Dr. Linguini was performing.
The bullet extraction procedure.
Yes.
Well, and the other way that Blake is like controlling the narrative is, of course, like how he dictates to Steven about Steven's, you know, little gay escapade from LA to Denver, and like, oh, you picked up a boy and you bought him beers and you plied him with liquor and traveled across the country with him, and how do you think that looks, you know? And it's like, but Steven's right there in the room. Steven knows what he was up to the last few weeks or however long this has been.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't even happen within the Denver city limits.
This is just like more of like, you know, Blake has to be in control and pull the strings. And like, it doesn't matter if it's your story, he's going to tell it his way. And
well, I like the fact that we have a character like Steven who constantly denies Blake that power. He's not going to let him. And in so much in this episode, he's like, I would rather stay in this prison prison than have to answer to you and have you bail me out and you tell me what my life is going to be and should be. And it obviously reaches a huge boiling point in the end of the episode. And he takes that out, not just on Blake, but the entire Carrington family, Carrington Associates, Joseph, the malicious major domo, and the crystalware.
What I like most about this episode is in the beginning, it's all kind of about breakfast and, you know, it's like it's morning again at the Carrington mansion.
Well, the episode does pick up immediately where it left off, which I kind of like when they do that.
Yeah, it sort of lends a sense of continuity, even though there's like zero continuity in this show.
Claudia's bullet ridden head.
I like seeing everybody like walking around in various states of undress, you know.
Nobody's ever undressed on this show except John James.
No, I mean undress in the sense of like they're not in like, they're going out of the house clothes. So it's like, right. It's a lot of like glamorous 90s and, you know, luxurious peignoirs.
The men
things.
Wear dress shirts under their robes. I mean, really.
Yeah. I mean, even Joseph, like, you know, I don't know what they're paying this guy, but, you know, I think he's got he's outdoing Blake in his dressing gown.
I will say the
and
only...
And naturally, of course, Blake wakes up in full suit and tie mode.
Yeah,
he's,
of course.
He's unlike the rest of them because he's like ready to go out for some corporate raiding and drill for blood money or whatever he does all day.
Or bail your son out for homosexual assault.
This won't be considered simple assault. It'll be homosexual assault. You did hit that man, and reason or not, you're going to have to answer for it.
But then meanwhile, over at Alexis's studio... They're having a kinky breakfast of pizza and rosé champagne, which I just, you know, I love this. I like, is it sort of a nod to brunch? Is it just, she just felt like having pizza? Is this what it's like when you're going to bed with Alexis? Like,
well,
the morning after is pizza and rosé champagne, I guess.
Well, sign me up. A nice hot slice is better than a cold one, right?
Shaped like a triangle, right?
No, I think Alexis explained it. They don't even let her in the house anymore to get a graham cracker. And she don't even like graham crackers.
She doesn't even like those anyway. She's like, screw y'all. Keep your graham crackers and your butter knives. I've got pizza on a silver tray.
Love that.
Yeah. And then she eats her pizza with a fork and knife. It's very kinky for breakfast for sure.
Yeah. I do have to say seeing her use a fork and knife darked me out a little bit because I generally find that a good way to figure out if somebody's psychotic or not is if they eat their pizza with a fork and knife.
I wouldn't go full psycho on that one. I mean, you know, like Seinfeld famously lampooned this with eating a candy bar with a fork and knife.
Right.
Which was more
it's
about
along the same lines.
Just being ridiculous, not psychotic. So, you know, two sides of the same coin, maybe. We're not sure. But
yeah, we finally have acknowledgement of what we knew was coming, and that's that Alexis has agreed to Cecil's 20-year-old marriage proposal or whatever.
She's finally gonna make good on that one.
Yeah, and you know, you can see in her eyes that this is strategy, honey. She's shifted from trying to woo Blake back, and she's going to use all of Cecil's money and power to get back at the Carringtons. And I think she likes fucking him too.
Yeah, it's very much implied how much sex they're having.
Well, these two get horny on their hatred for Blake, both of them.
Yeah, no, they're turning on to this whole like hatred of Blake thing together.
He's vile, he's arrogant, and I'd like nothing more than to see him destroyed.
Are you serious?
Oh, I'm deadly serious. Well, don't you hate Blake Carrington too?
I mean, as a business competitor?
Isn't anything.
And I'll put it this way. There's no love lost between me and Blake Carrington.
That's very, very good. That puts us on the same side, as it were.
I think she was about to blast off. She was like, tell me more about how much we hate Blake, you know?
Well, it made sense why the director was close up on this scene, because I didn't want to see what was going on down below that kimono.
Well, and sidebar, this is not a look of the week, but as far as morning attire goes, like, Alexis is killing it in her very sort of culturally appropriating cheesy kimono thing, but it has like the big shoulder thing, so it's for the times, and it's on theme as well. I just like what she's got on in the morning better than everybody else.
Yeah, when Pepe's Pizza is delivering a morning slice, you're not gonna wear a robe, you know, you're gonna put something nice on. A morning after slice.
But the other thing I like about their dialogue here, Cecil is like getting a little bit literary, you know, like he drops this like George Bernard Shaw quote, which I actually like the Oscar Wilde version better, which is that, you know, there's two great tragedies in life. One is not getting what you want, and the other is getting it. George Bernard Shaw kind of rephrases it in the way that Cecil quotes, and I don't think is
well. Cecil's not going to quote a queer, dear.
Well, they didn't look at it that way. They were quoting literature, and it didn't matter. You know, we didn't ascribe so much authorial intent to things back then. But oh, we have to talk about this limo. It's so funny because I didn't even think about it. You called it out. It's, you know, this limo like got grenaded like, I don't know, 10 episodes ago. And now it's back. So it's the same make and model, but this is a 3-year-old used car at this point. So
look, Blake likes it. He's got the money. He took it to the body shop and he got that shit redone.
He probably just found another one just like it, or I don't know. But, you know, I guess he just wasn't into the boxy Panther body Lincolns of 1981. So
one thing I'm not into is the introduction of this new character, Susan the nurse. It felt a little abrupt. Her and Dr. Puccini apparently have some backstory. So they run into each other in the nursery and she's like, oh, I don't really want to go live with the Carringtons and be the baby nurse. I'd rather live in the Toscani house on the hills. And I'm like, bitch, what are you talking about? The Carrington mansion is way better than Dr. Nick's hippie den in the woods.
One would think, but here's the thing. They're talking about, like, I think Blake even says something, I'm so glad that Claudia doesn't have to go back to the sanitarium. You know, he's talking to, like, Dr. Nick after, you know, she has her big revelation to them about who shot the gun. And I'm just thinking, no, she's living in the nut house. The Carrington Mansion is a nut house.
It's for sure crazier.
It's being run by the inmates. And like, as much as Blake might control everything, he has no control over all of the crazy shit that's going on in his own house, under his own roof.
But anyway, didn't you find the introduction of Susan kind of jarring?
You know, there's something about this show that's almost more about the potential than what you actually end up getting on the screen. And I think she's a good example of that because she's played by Christine Belford, who sort of turned up in like commercials at the time. And then I guess she was on, you know, random shows doing like parts like this, basically.
She does have a very recognizable face.
I guess she was in Christine,
face.
The movie. She has a very recognizable face.
Oh, yes.
Face.
That's where I know her from.
I kind of like her here. I just don't know what they're doing with her. And
oh, well, it's
I feel like she's being set up.
Anything
like,
good because
well, she's
bitch
no Nurse
is
Ratched,
no Mary Poppins.
She's, well, she's no Nurse Ratched either. Like,
well, she's no Mary Poppins.
You can tell she's up to no good, but in what way, you're not really sure. And then turns out maybe she's a MacGuffin because it's crazy Claudia that's going to pick up the baby at the end of the episode. Like,
well, obviously,
for
this baby is not safe. Something bad is going to, I mean, already.
Well, with all these insane people running around in this house, like, this baby has zero chance. Like, somebody is gonna pick the black marble.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, I'm getting like kidnappy vibes from her because she has an issue with the 1%. Every line that she delivers is like, I can't believe that this baby's a prince, and oh, aren't you so lucky you get to live in Buckingham Palace? It's like, the baby didn't have anything to do with that.
Yeah, she has an axe to grind. We're not sure what exactly it is, but I guess we'll find out in the next episode, or maybe she was just on here for a bit part and that's it. Like, that went nowhere.
Or maybe she'll marry Stephen Carrington.
Let's talk about nurseries.
Cannabis?
So maybe the brain center in this whole circus tent that these people are living in is this insane, very creepy nursery. In some ways, it's very quintessential, though. It's like full of like chintz prints and baby blue, literally. But then, like, what's going on with like the insanely creepy stuffed animals, which this child is never going to play with?
No, those animals are going to come to life and haunt that child's dreams every night.
And there's a great like sort of like zoom back with the camera, and so you like you see one little sort of creepy Humpty Dumpty, but then like he's got a girlfriend Humpty Dumpty, and then like there's small duck wearing a bonnet, and then there's a big duck wearing a bonnet.
I think there's also a medium and an extra small duck wearing bonnets.
Yeah, it's like a whole gaggle of ducks or whatever a group of ducks would be called.
Yeah, I mean, you thought Pennywise from It was creepy? Ugh, just go into Baby Blake's
clowns
nursery.
Are just level one. Once we get to ducks and Humpty Dumpties, that's like level 12 or something. I don't know. And
bone chilling.
This poor child, like, you know he's doomed just from the way the nursery is festooned. And then you had like the classic brass swinging crib thing, which I feel like was always sort of a little like sudden infant death syndrome kind of like furniture.
Oh, yeah, those have been recalled.
They would like give them away on Price is Right.
They're all in a landfill somewhere. Like,
what's this guy gonna do with a brass baby bassinet, whatever? Like, and you gotta pay the taxes on those prizes. That's the other thing. Price is Right is a trick, y'all.
It is nice to see Fallon embracing motherhood. We have her and Jeff coming back together. They're going to make it work for the baby, which is obviously going to be a disaster, but I don't know.
Wasn't that what we learned from the 70s and 80s? That, like, instead of getting divorced, which is highly an option, we can just stay together for the baby, which, like, as we know, like, really never works out. But as Fallon says, like, maybe that's not worse than all the arguments and the fighting we have.
Very Dr. Laura of her.
Sham marriage.
Speaking of sham marriages, Stephen confronts his mother after, you know, his legal altercation and finally gets confirmation that, yes, Alexis paid to send that little tramp Sammy Joe away.
Yeah, here we are having this like very frank discussion between Stephen and his mother. But also, this is the same garden which apparently Fallon's bedroom window now overlooks.
Continuity error.
So I mean, it's all very convenient. So of course she can see.
Yeah, it was literally like 8 or 10 episodes ago. She was looking out and there was a giant tree she used to climb. And now she can see the garden, which is obviously an indoor set.
It's always something about like receiving knowledge and how it screws everything up in the fall of man. And here she is like seeing Dr. Nick and Crystal. And of course, like in classic soap opera logic, like she doesn't really know what's going on. She just sees Dr. Nick kissing Crystal and just assumes, oh yeah, they, you know, they're stepping out with each other.
Yeah, I think the writers are just tying up all those loose threads with the three-way between Crystal and Dr. Nick and Fallon, and we're moving on.
Okay,
from that,
so
which I like
the thing with Crystal in this episode. This is very classic, and I want to dissect it a bit because Crystal sort of like gets painted as like, oh, this poor put upon woman, and like her life is so hard and she's so nice and why does everybody treat her so badly? Crystal like tries to, you know, console Claudia, and Claudia like just totally turns crazy on her. You know, basically she gets bitched out by Claudia over the whole Matthew situation.
Well, rightfully so.
Yeah, actually, yes, rightfully so. Like, but see, here's the thing. This is how things look versus like what the facts are. Like Crystal like looks like this like sweet, nice lady who's just trying to make good, and Claudia looks like a super nut job. But it's like, no, Claudia really should be bitching her out over the whole Matthew thing. Then you've also got like Fallon giving Crystal the what for over, you know, Nick Toscani.
Look, Crystal, I don't like you around the baby. I can handle him. I don't need my father's wife to help. I'm not going to take this as an insult, Fallon, because I think I know what's eating you. It has something to do with Nick, doesn't it? Fallon, I was never really involved with him, and I'm not now. And I'm not holding him with any invisible strings. If you've lost him and you want to know the source, just look into any mirror in the house.
Like, Crystal really is not as, like, sweet and innocent and unblameable as she might like look at first blush.
No, she has her bitchy moments.
She has her bitchy moments, but like here she just looks so like, why is everybody being so mean to her? And it's like, no, she deserves all of this. Like, she's just as bad as the rest of them, which is what I love, because like, you know, Steven calls it all out at the end, like puts everybody on read, including Crystal. And like, she's no less blameless than the rest of them, but like, don't be mistaken, like, by appearances, like, she's not this sweet, innocent, you know, woman who got dragged in to all of this mess at the Carringtons.
Yeah, I loved his monologue. It was very much a callback for me to the dinner party episode from the first season, or not the dinner party,
the birthday party.
The
Absolutely.
Birthday party, with Jeff calling out everybody for being deplorables. And here we have Steven doing it. Now, if you recall, Steven wasn't part of that. He didn't get to go to New Orleans for Cecil's birthday party. So this is his take on that. And now Jeff is part of it too.
Jeff has been co-opted, and obviously we've already talked about, like, Jeff has like no testicles at this point, so he's just another smiling buffoon in this crowd.
Well, and he's propping up Blake and all of his evil doings as well, maybe because he has daddy issues himself, but you know, we haven't really explored that. But what's really disheartening is how Alexis is part of this as well, because Steven and Alexis, I think, have had more of a bond, but he just breaks it off with
everybody. I think
that's
important to note, how Alexis has now been fully grouped in with the rest of these people.
In Steven's eyes,
In Steven's eyes, but I think also if you're an audience that was liking Alexis, this is sort of a moment where you do realize, oh no, she's we all knew she was evil, but in a fun way, but now she's just like evil in the same way that the rest of these people are, and she's being really called out on the floor for her own hypocrisy, which really applies to all of these people.
I do like how they all kind of group up though and call Sammy Joe out.
Yeah, they were not having it with her. Like, she was a rejected donor.
I almost wonder if the actors didn't really like Heather Locklear, and so they were putting it all in.
Ooh,
there.
They were jealous. Yeah,
I mean, she was the hottest person on the show. The other part about this speech is it's kind of a coming out moment, even though we all know that he's had homosexual relationships.
It's fascinating to me because I think this was like an entire full-blown scene. I mean, this is like 5 minutes.
It was a play. It was like an act of a play.
Yeah. So they spent a lot of time on this one issue, which is essentially Steven says it, that he's a homosexual. He is gay. And, you know, like, look, this keeps going back to what the writers would say, what they were allowed to say, what the tensions were with producers and we can't do this or that. I don't know. And like, at the end of the day, all you can do is like assess what's on the screen. Steven says he's gay. I don't know. Like, I think we would all sort of say, like, reclassify him now as like a bisexual character, which I think is great. However, we keep going back to this like problem of...
Now, here's one thing I wanted to talk to you about. I feel like his sexuality is also getting mixed up with his relationship with his father. He's kind of using his sexuality against his father because he knows that his father is anti-gay.
My take on that, because Blake sets it up in the beginning in that interrogation room at the police department, he sets it up as, I don't have to lie, he says to Steven, implying that
your life is a lie.
Your life is a lie, or because you are engaging in unapproved sexual behaviors, you have to lie about it in order to function in society. So to me, it's not Steven using it against him so much. I think it's more Steven pointing out that you all are a bunch of hypocrites, and I'm gay, and by the way, gay is not lying. Gay is my only truth. And that's why I'm saying it right here and right now. And the rest of you people have way worse things to be lying about in your own lives. So that's how I see that dynamic.
I would agree with that. That's a very intellectual approach.
I would call it scatterbrained, but okay, I'll accept that.
You know what really hurts me the most? Is I hate what you all stand for. I hate your values, your morals, and your blindness. But I love you. I love you all very much.
As much as I appreciate Steven, like, being sort of, like, the moral center all of a sudden, like, where the hell has he been most of this season? Like, he's sort of just been, like, just a cheap prop, you know, for Blake and the rest of the family to sort of bounce things off of.
But, well, he did get married to his child bride, Sammy Jo.
Even that was, like, a prop, you know? Like, he even says, like, I was with boys, you didn't like that, so I brought a woman home and you didn't like her. And
well, that's what I'm saying with his sexuality. I think he's just still trying to either seek Blake's approval or be completely defiant of Blake. The pendulum is always back and forth.
It remains to be seen if he's like trying things on or if he's just going
now,
through this
after that
journey
scene in the library. We are getting a Steven who is more confident in himself. He's been spending this whole season figuring it out, experimenting, trying different things. I mean, hell, he's been doing that the whole time we've known this character. But I think now that monologue is him putting his foot down against the family and for himself.
I think it's a great monologue on its own. However, when you put it in the context of where has Steven really been, why is he suddenly the moral center of the Dynasty universe at this moment, at least? Like, in a way, he's kind of just kind of, he's returned to what he was about 30 episodes ago.
Well, yeah, but that's
Blake's
fault.
So I'm like, we just went on this big
fault.
Circular journey. Like, oh yeah, it's not his fault, but
I guess it's everybody's fault. But at least Fallon kind of has his back, which is nice. So I'm excited to see what's going to happen because there's just so much drama in the air. You know, we've got this proposal. It seems like Alexis has some ideas of what she wants her wedding reception to be. Steven is totally against the family. There's an evil nurse next to a crazy woman. There's just so much drama in the Carrington
mansion. Definitely a lot of ingredients, but we'll see if we just wind up with burnt bacon and egregious eggs or, you know, a light and fluffy quiche.
Now it's time for our look of the week. This is the part of the episode where Kyler and I choose our favorite lurks from the episode.
We don't choose them, they choose us.
I'm going to go a little bit off script here. Not that we have a script, but you know, we had some nice looks from Crystal. Alexis served two really great ensembles, but I want to give attention to a little moment that was so delicious and completely unnecessary. And that is the pimp and the hoe in the interrogation room before Blake meets up with Steven. I think I'm going to give it to the pimp. This
first
tall glass of water. Excuse me. Don't interrupt me when I'm describing a pimp's outfit because I will pimp slap you.
You've already gone 12 sentences and I have a lot of things that I think you're dropping stuff that's just assumptions. Like the big one is, how do we know that this is a pimp and this is a hooker?
Well, this is my interpretation of the scene, but they're in an interrogation room. He is wearing a suit, carrying a big white hat. He's got like a big
flamboyant white pocket square.
Yeah, well, it's not a pocket square.
It's not a square.
It almost looks like a big flower. And you know this man has money because he's got a big gold ring on his finger. It almost looks like it could be like brass knuckles or something. I don't know what he did, but it was not pleasant to his female companion that,
well,
he was meeting up with.
I have to wonder if this was the product of the director, because I don't even imagine they would have written this into the script. There was no real, like, you know, driving moment from this. But it's certainly there to set the mood, I guess, before Steven and Blake enter this room.
Yeah, I guess that was the reason for it. I don't know. But there's like, just so much
going
on.
These would normally just be extras in a background, but they kind of get their own moment. So,
and I forgot to mention, the pimp suit is burgundy. It's a delicious shade of red.
Well,
reddish purple.
So, yeah, it's interesting because he's in this sort of very, like, 5 years ago dressy pimp attire, which it's sort of like pimp dressing, I guess, sort of was frozen in that moment,
like
in
a
time.
Shaft kind of a situation.
Yes, it's like no pimps can ever dress in current trends after that moment, apparently. It's always got to be a wide brim hat and a 1970s-esque suit,
big old collar poking
right
out.
Big butterfly collar for sure. And on the other hand, the merchandise he's selling, which is a very rude way, but obviously it's a very rude relationship, she is like in this Pat Benatar look. So she's like kind of like way on the opposite end of the spectrum. You know, it's like the extreme, almost bad on purpose makeup with the short haircut and, you know, the striped jersey knit, you know, almost tube dress, but not quite. I don't know. It's very interesting, these two together.
It's not too sexy either, because she's not serving cleavage. There's barely any leg. The dress almost goes to the knee, but it is very like flirty and fun and casual. So I guess if you needed to access the merchandise, it might be kind of easy. I don't know, to take off. That was my interpretation of it. To be clear, she is not my look of the week. The pimp is my look of the week. What's your look of the week,
really?
Color?
I think these two together are a look, because they kind of need each other. I don't know that we would have noticed this little moment as much if either or both of them had
that
not
is
been.
So misogynistic of you to say that a prostitute needs a pimp.
No, I'm saying that these outfits need each other.
Oh.
Because otherwise they're just sort of a little bit random, but like the two of them are so jarring. I don't know. It's like it's clearly illustrating what's happening in that one small scene.
Yeah.
You know, so good directing in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, there's runners up. Alexis had that great Asian look. But again, when she goes too costumey like that, it doesn't excite me as much. And then at the end, she was wearing that great black and gold number. I just felt like there wasn't enough gold. It just kind of seemed like two sleeves floating
through
the
Carrington
Mansion.
Yeah, I was actually just going to give the look of the week to her arms, because
yeah, it was all about the arms.
The gold lamé puff sleeves were like doing it for me, but everything else was a little bit. I mean, I like that you know, gold cable chain she was wearing, which sort
the
of
necklace,
like, yeah, which sort
oh,
of like
I didn't like that.
Complimented.
I thought
the,
it was boring.
The neckline. I thought, yeah, of course it's boring, but it's boring in like in a tasteful, nuanced way, not like in a it doesn't do anything way. But yeah, not the most exciting looks. This episode is very much about what's happening and not really what things look like.
Yeah.
So I appreciate
it. I mean,
that.
I do think that for the roast of the Carringtons at the end, everybody looked great. And, you know, we don't see the characters all together, especially like in the same shot a lot. So that was nice. And they did look great, but they weren't as exciting to me as the pimp and the hooker's 2 seconds in the interrogation room. So kudos to those extras. I hope they enjoy their accolade
from
us.
One thing I took away from your call with La Joan is that she apparently was suggesting costume to Nolan Miller and asking to be dressed in certain ways. I used to think she was just being given a lot of love, but I think she just was like, hey, I want to wear this or have this silhouette, or I need to be a little more glamorous than Crystal, or whatever it might have been that she was saying to them, or whatever they were doing for her based on her suggestions. Who knows? But
yeah,
like you could tell that here. I mean, out of everybody in the room, she's the one with the most interesting clothes on.
Well, that's another edition of Dynasty as They Want to Be. Kyler, thank you so much for joining me again.
Bake me a cheesecake and call me Blanche Devereaux.
Well, I also want to thank Sauce Beauty for sponsoring our podcast. And
sponsoring my do.
Yeah, next
people
week.
People wouldn't quit putting their hands on my hair tonight.
Well, you have pretty fucking flawless hair, I will have to say.
I'll let you say it. I won't say it because that's tacky.
Okay. Well, I said it. Your hair is fucking flawless. Check out our bonus episode on patreon.com/nastypodcast. Until next week, this has been Dynasty as They Want to Be.